my first question, okay, was going to be explain quantum computing to a simple boy like me. And it turns out you wrote the goddamn book on it. Quantum Computing for Babies. And oh, it's illustrated.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And made of cardboard.
Oh, my God. Because a real book, I'd get a paper cut. Yeah, it's a liability. And we didn't sign that release on the way in.
I'm gonna send you a real book, though, because I thought naturally the follow-on to Quantum Computing for Babies should be Quantum Computing for Dummies, which Floyd Smith and I are doing with Wiley.
So okay.
I think that comes out in September.
Okay.
Then you can get that paper cut. Because once you read this...
You know that's an indirect insult,
so,
right?
You're like so in it. You'll love it.
You're like, you're not just a baby. You're a dummy.
No, I'm going to send you one of those little finger things, tab through the pages.
Okay.
I have one for reading all these physics books I'm doing to do all the research. Okay.
It's like a protector.
I've literally got the paper cut.
Oh, shit. So, you know, for the folks that obviously can't see this wonderful book, what's the elevator pitch like for quantum? Because
that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's literally my favorite thing. So,
okay.
Think about this. From the iPhone, Samsung, whatever you're carrying around in your pocket, through the people listening, all the way to the greatest supercomputer, these systems all use binary systems. We use bits to calculate on.
Mm-hmm.
So if I have 4 bits, I have 16 outcomes, and I could be in any one of those outcomes at any given moment in time.
Okay.
Now, take a salt atom, blow it up, pull an electron off, suspend it with lasers, or cool it down almost to absolute zero, and all of a sudden I can calculate on this atomic particle. And so that's called a qubit. And if I have 4 qubits, I still have the same 16 outcomes.
Right.
I can be in every possible outcome at the same moment in time.
So you're calculating and you're approximating a lot more things simultaneously.
That's right. And in addition, the power curve grows exponentially. So if I have those 4 bits and I add a 5th bit, I have 25 outcomes.
Okay.
But if I have 4 qubits and I add a 5th qubit,
I
have 2 to the n the number of bits.
Which is big as fuck.
That's right. Big as fuck.
Which is a scientific
way to
term.
Describe it. It's a very scientific term.
Okay. So you're using... how are these machines built? Like, is the circuitry, is this theoretical? Is this real?
So they're real and they're commercialized already.
Okay.
Now, they're not to where we probably read about them in the press and there's a lot of hype around them. Okay. But if you think about it, you know, you say, well, you know, what was your first computer? Did you have a first computer?
I did. It was either an HP. I think it was an HP or a compact. No, it was a compact Presario.
Okay.
Yeah, it was for some reason, it was either in the kitchen or my mom's room. It was like the last place I wanted it to be.
Right. Of course.
Like I just wanted to build my AOL hacking programs in peace.
Right.
And just, you know, do me.
So it was definitely in the kitchen.
It was definitely in the kitchen. She's like, did you just kick off Kansas from the internet again? I'm like, Mom. Right.
So what happens is, you know, we have a lot of people look at these machines. They say, well, we're going to take a wait and see attitude. And I'm here to warn everybody, you cannot take a wait and see attitude on this technology. You'll be left so far behind. And the reason
meaning companies or me
companies,
okay.
People, you know, training for jobs, this is going to be put it in perspective, the industrial revolution, right? The information revolution, and now a quantum revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just computers, it's sensors, it's communications, a quantum internet. So this is going to be one of the biggest technological shifts we've went through as a species, and it's going to converge with artificial intelligence. And at the point where those two meet, that's where I've been trying to live my life out in the future for the last 7 years.
Well, that was my next question, because you know, we're all feeling like we're living in the future with AI. We have the tools. We basically have the raw ingredients to do whatever we fucking want. We don't know how to use it yet.
Yeah.
It's, I heard a really great example the other, I think it was Chamath. He said, this is like refrigeration, just technology. And then it was like, now you get beer and milk that doesn't spoil. And like you're fucking have one in your house and you could keep food forever and this kind of good stuff. Right. It's like, we have these raw ingredients. We're not sure how to use it. So when you apply quantum, because quantum is just another layer that empowers AI.
That's right.
Because of the computational power.
Well, so think about it a little differently. Think about quantum needs artificial intelligence because there are so many problems we still need to explore to perfect the technology, right? So we need the help, some computer assistance, if you will, to really discover some new fundamental physics breakthroughs, to manage things like noise control and fidelity on the machines.
Okay.
And then AI needs quantum because I believe artificial intelligence will quickly start building algorithms and programs that don't run on classical infrastructure. And so, so I think these two are very symbiotic and almost codependent. I've said many times on stage, I don't believe that you can have true artificial intelligence without a quantum computer. Because if you think about it, nature is quantum mechanical. So let's say your brain is quantum mechanical. Some people agree with that in the neuroscience community. Some don't.
Yeah.
But if we go with that, then if you want to recreate a brain, which is kind of one of the goals of artificial intelligence, then you need a quantum computer to do that, right?
And is that a factor of, okay, I'm stepping out of my... Stepping out of my league, y'all.
It's okay. I've been out of my league this whole time. Good. This whole company. So we're in it together, brother.
So the idea of the way AI is structured is these various, these nets, like all different layers of trying to approximate what a computer, what a brain would be in a computer's way.
Sure. Like neural nets.
Neural nets. Now, when you apply quantum here, what happens? Do these, you just have the ability to make endless amounts of guesses and approximations so much faster the way that a human brain could do potentially.
So let's back it up and talk about what would be the difference between a quantum computer and a classical computer.
Yeah.
Like, why do we need these things?
Right.
So think about it. There are so many problems in the world, you know, diseases, the environment, you know, you can go on and on. In Brussels, they have the thing that's called the World Encyclopedia of Problems. It's like 56,000 problems we're facing as a species.
Okay.
Right. It's like the horror Wikipedia.
Right.
You go and you read it and you're like, that's, I didn't even know that was a thing.
Right.
So think about why we'd use these machines. So let's take a classic traveling salesman problem. Let's say that you want to go to 14 cities in the most optimized route.
Right.
And you look like you got a MacBook Air there, just like me.
Yep.
And I write you an application on there and we do that. It takes maybe 3,000 to 5,000 seconds and we have all the variables figured out. We know exactly how we want to go on that trip in the most optimized fashion.
Right.
Now, all of a sudden you say, you know what? I miss Orly in Austin. We got to meet in Chicago. Mm-hmm. Let's add some extra cities. You go from 14 to call it 22. Okay. Difference of 8. That same computer, that same laptop would take thousands of years to get to that answer. And if you went to 28 cities, it would take longer than the time of the known universe.
Right.
So these are what you call intractable problems. So these are, you know, in scientific terms, you know, NP, NP plus hard, BQP in mathematics terms rather. And as you get to these problems, they just, it's not that a classical computer couldn't do it. That it would take it thousands or tens of thousands, or if you get into breaking encryption or trying to find cures for cancer, doing some molecular stuff, millions of years to run that problem. And so they're faster, not like it's not going to make this podcast faster,
right?
But it is going to take a process of, say, finding a molecular bond that could cure a cancer.
Because it's just running all these experiments faster. Simultaneously.
Because it's kind of like a black box, just like an AI. So we can put verbose mode on. We can see what a computer does. We can't see what a quantum computer does. So we know that we can explore all of the possible possibilities at once and think of it like a coin toss, right? So I often use a coin as a, take a coin, put it on the desk, head is up, it's a one.
Right.
Tails up, it's a zero. On the two-dimensional plane, that's binary.
Yep.
Take the same coin, flip it in the air like a coin toss. At the top of that spin, at the apex, is it a one or a zero? And it's in a quantum superposition of every possibility of one or zero. And until we stop it, just like a coin toss, and measure it by putting it on the back of our hand, we don't collapse the system. So when we stop it, we ask the computer, we get the answer out, then it collapses to ones and zeros. It's the process of having explored this huge problem space. So think about it, because you know, I know a little bit about your background. I know you think about it like a bell curve.
Yeah, I mean, I'm applying this to either trading or probability.
So think about this like a bell curve and think that when I look at bell curve, there's a standard deviation, right? There's at the top of that curve, all of my answers are probably somewhere in that track.
Right.
Now think of a quantum computer being more like vampire fangs. And so it's wider and taller on the outside and we search a wider broth of information. And because of that, we get to answers that we might not have gotten to.
Leptokurtosis, so, fat tails distribution.
So think of a phone book, right? For your listeners, think of a phone book and think, I have your name, but not your number. A standard computer, classical computer, line by line by line to find the answer. A quantum computer would, using something like Grover's search algorithm, only need the square root of the number of entries to get to the same answer. That makes it crystal clear, right? Nailed it. I'm out.
Yeah, you're done. Drop the mic. Oh, man. So you have...
And by the way, Everyone has trouble. Scientists working in this space have trouble wrapping their heads around some of this.
Right.
So like no one should feel, I think one of the big things I'm on a mission to do is like kind of democratize it and normalize it. That's why I wrote the baby's book and the dummies book, is I want everybody to realize that these technologies are coming and that there's an opportunity for everybody, right? Because at the end of the day, everybody's worried about, you know, the problem in the industry is that we're trying to apply it to the problems we have today. Right. And so you're like, how
the known
can I do,
problem
how
set
can I do trading? Right. Exactly. Everybody's like, where can I get, you know, this eke out a little efficiency, or I can do something that gives me a competitive advantage.
Right.
Wrong way to look at these machines. These machines aren't for the problems of the past or the present. They're for the opportunities of the future.
Mm.
This isn't about, you know, making a better trading algorithm or portfolio optimization, which are all things you can do with a quantum computer. This isn't about, so the way I like to put it is, I'm not interested in better drug discovery. I'm interested in curing and eliminating diseases.
Mm.
I'm not interested in better battery chemistry for electric vehicles. I'm interested in completely new forms of travel that will come out of this.
Raise the goddamn bar, everybody.
We're living in the greatest time to be alive in the history of our species. And things are going to change at a rate so exponentially faster than it has over the last 50-100 years in computing, that entire corporations will fall behind. There could be new class divisions with, you know, people who have access to AI and people who don't, et cetera, et cetera. We're about to go through so much change. And so I'm on a mission to make sure as many people, I don't give a shit about your background. I don't care what you've done.
Right.
I would love to make you a quantum ready, artificially intelligent person. And what's great is, think about it. You don't know how to program. Now you have AIs that do.
Right.
So people who don't know how to program, now maybe they actually could do something because they have an idea and they can describe it. So we're
and that's democratic.
That, well, think about it this way. We're about to see the rise, you know, what I call the rise of the non-creative creative class. Everybody that came to me when I was—
Dude, I'm
going to
steal all the shit that you're saying right now.
Man, dude, are you kidding me? I'm all over this stuff. That's going to be
fucking
my new
book.
So here's the deal. So the rise of the non-creative creative class, what does that mean?
Uh-huh.
That means that we have people that used to come to me and say, oh, I've got the best idea for an app. If I could only code, or could you help me or whatever. Now they don't need to come to me. Now they can go to ChatGPT and say, how do I build an app?
Correct.
What code is it written in? Could you write that code?
Right.
They can go to GitHub and use, you know, the GitHub Copilot.
Yeah.
They can, there's all these
provide
tools.
Me with a UX UI that would kind of work for this type of software.
Think about AutoGPT. What are a lot of people using that for right now?
Right.
They're using it to build website. Build me a website that has these things and it builds it and writes the code. And yeah, it's ugly and you and I are both design like big design freaks. That's why I like it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you think about it, what's going to be the difference? You know, I spoke to a giant media company in New York yesterday, very panicked about the AI. And I gave them a presentation I thought was heartwarming and comforting. Bullshit. I started with the audio clip and a fake generated image of Steve Jobs.
Uh-huh.
And if you want it, I'll play it for you. It's on my phone. But it's Steve Jobs welcoming my team to our quarterly meeting.
Uh-huh.
And then the next slide was, you know, here's this other thing. And the next slide was the Drake and Weeknd song that came out. And it was like, yeah, it's too late. Like, you're like, how do we keep them from scanning our stuff or doing this or doing that?
Oh,
it's
please.
Like, yeah, that ship sailed years ago.
Like, yeah.
Sure, you can kind of keep them, but can you keep people from taking that information and sharing it? Can you, I mean, it's the cat's out of the bag, the genie's out of the bottle, however you want to put it. And so right now is the most important time in the history of, you know, our nation, the world, everything, that we get people actively engaged in really learning. We need to get out of the VC cycle we've been in of, you know, funding social media sites and crazy stuff.
Uh-huh.
And you're starting to see a trend of funding a lot more deep tech. You're starting to see, you know, the Palantirs and the data science.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting to see the, you know, the, I mean, sure, the car companies, Tesla and everybody, they're great, but I'm talking more about like the SpaceX's, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking more about the companies doing CRISPR.
Hyper experimental.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because that is the future, and things that were out of our reach that were science fiction will very soon be science fact.
Hmm. The way that I'm thinking about quantum is like, if you're a snowboarder, it's like doing a backflip versus doing a Misty flip. It's just like 1-0 or
maybe
what the fuck just
only
happened?
Only if when you go to do the flip, as soon as you start the flip, nobody can see anything.
Everything turns off.
You, and then on the other side of it, you land or don't land the flip. That's a little more accurate.
Every other possible option, including disappearing.
Right. Or just like you just boom and you crashed.
Right. Right.
And that's, look, there's problems with the machines right now, right? There's decoherence times. So what you're basically doing, you know,
decoherence times is like, I don't know where what just happened back there, everybody.
Well, no, it's even weirder. It's like the computer doesn't exist in this space-time. So what happens is, so here's what happens.
Okay.
So there's a bunch of ways to make a quantum computer, and adding qubits to a computer when you see about how many there are, that's not the problem. The problem is adding a qubit without the fidelity of the system going to crap, and then you can't get an answer out. So what
you're like, where'd you go? Where'd you go?
Yeah, literally. So, you know, my joke was when we first started StrangeWorks, I was like, you know, how can I explain this? Oh yeah, we write software for computers that don't exist, right? And then it was, we write software for kind of lab equipment, and now it's become very, very real. But when you think about it, how are you making a quantum computer? There are dozens of ways. So ion traps use lasers to suspend, a particle.
Okay.
And then we use microwave pulses to rotate it around. So instead of that coin, think of a qubit more like a football. I grew up in Germany, a soccer ball.
Okay.
Uh-huh. If it's pointed straight up, it's one, straight down to zero. Uh-huh. That soccer ball could be an electron off a salt atom. It could be a helium electron. It could be tons of things. And you could trap it with lasers, or you could freeze it down to where it stops moving.
Okay.
But all of these things have a decoherence time, meaning that eventually, as you start calculating on them, the system decoheres, the bonds get broken, and all of a sudden now it's not really a computer anymore. So these things are very special purpose-built machines. No doubt people should stop looking at them like it's here to break the internet and it's just a computer. But they're special purpose-built machines that will do things that will lead to a general quantum computer, just like we have artificial people saying artificial general intelligence.
Sure.
I don't know why they put the G there. I mean, I get it.
Hey, bring it down to the people, but, y'all.
Maybe, you know.
It's the po' boy sandwich of...
Maybe I should start saying quantum general computer, but you know, it's very interesting and how you make these things. I'm actually going to tour a facility here in Chicago with a company called AeroQ. So a good buddy of mine, Nick Verena, he is a serial entrepreneur who also got into quantum years ago.
Okay.
And they're doing helium electrons. And so they're here in Chicago and they're building a fab a little outside of the city. And so when I leave here, we can go have lunch. I'm going to go out and check out the fab. So these things, dude, everybody has this a lot closer to them than they think, right? Universities in Florida, because you know, you're living down there. There's plenty of quantum projects. There's plenty of AI projects. This stuff is coming up. The problem you're going to have is, I've been describing for 5 years a moment in time where quantum computing out of nowhere becomes everything.
Okay.
Okay. And nobody believed me until ChatGPT, because all those large language models existed. What happened was we changed the interface and people accepted it, and all of a sudden it blew up.
Yeah.
So think about how fast they got from zero to 100 million users, how fast they got past. Think of the $100 billion in market cap Google lost when they're, hey, we've got one, two, demo failed.
Yeah.
Now think about all that happening with a computing system made from nature, made from literally the atomic elements of nature. We split the atom to destroy two cities in Japan.
Right.
We split the atom to create nuclear power. Now we're splitting it for computing. And the effects will be greater than both of those two events combined as far as where it drives humanity.
One thing, excuse me for a second.
That's okay.
Let me just collect myself. One thing that I think propelled, when we talk about, you know, these models being around since the 80s in AI, right? Mm-hmm. One thing that propelled it to the forefront is there's an alignment and a necessity of people using it. Number one, it was fun to use and we need you to use it because your binary yes, no, good, bad will improve the model to a point. And then, of course, it starts to degrade the model. But the idea is we give it to you to use for free because you're our human testers, realizes, right?
Or I think slightly differently, co-collaborators/ sources of new data.
Yeah.
Once you've crawled all the internet, where do you go to get new data?
Right.
I go to you.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Because you're going to think of things I didn't think of. You're going to be asking questions I didn't think
of. Yeah.
So really, and by the way, is there anything wrong with that? You know, when I was speaking in New York yesterday, I did three talks up there yesterday, all around publishing stuff with different groups. And it's like, they're like, well, they looked at our content and they did that. They had two questions that really bugged me. One was, and this was the third group I talked to in the evening last night. They said, well, how do we know that it's right? What if it's right? Most of the time, and then it prints something wrong and we print that. And I said, so you're telling me your publications never printed a retraction? Right. By the way, do you not have an editorial process that fact checks that?
Right.
Why would you just blindly be like, okay, ChatGPT, write the article. You'd still fact check it, right?
Right.
Like it doesn't change. And the point being is that these new technologies, especially artificial intelligence, they change what we do, right? No. They change who we are? No. They don't change what we do. They don't change who we are. They change how we do it.
Sure.
They're like, you know, you know, people say you have your brain, you have your second brain, your gut.
Uh-huh.
You now have a third brain, which is AI.
Right.
If you've ever read Diamond Age by Neal Stephens, right? Little street merchant is walking down the street. This scientist had built a primer to make their child the smartest person on earth, uh-huh. or whatever, and has a heart attack or something, a stroke, dies on the street. And this little street girl finds it and she becomes one of the most uh-huh. powerful people because she has this knowledge, right? The story's all about her journey. And so you think about it, you know, I want to get that knowledge to as many people as possible
sure.
now, because developers are out of a job.
Yeah.
Lawyers, a lot of them, really going to be impacted.
Yeah.
I was planning on spending about $1.5 million on patents. Mm-hmm. I'm not doing that anymore. I found a way to use these systems in a way that doesn't break any of the new rulings by the patent office to generate new IP in the form of a patent.
Mm.
And so instead of $1.5 million.
Without now, breaking a sweat, probably.
Now, right. And now I'm estimating, and without the pressure, and now I'm estimating I'll spend $50,000 to $100,000 to do that same job.
Okay.
You know, you think about developers, we already have code in our product that was written, co-collaborating with AI.
Sure.
You look at these things, you say, wow. I mean, I went on stage at South by and I said, there'll be total unemployment by 2060. I'm moving that up to 2050. And Goldman Sachs came out with a report a few weeks later after everybody kind of laughed and said 300 million people will lose their job or have it degraded by AI in about a 36-month period, I believe, if I remember correct. And I might not be remembering correct, but a very short period. And
but,
so
you think about that and you say,
where are we at? Well, here's where we're at. We're at people. This is not new. First of all, the doomsday predictions on AI, they're ridiculous. Okay. I think Elon's ridiculous. I think they're all ridiculous.
We align on this.
There's three bad outcomes.
Uh-huh.
Terminator kills us all.
Right.
iRobot got to put you in a prison to protect you from yourself.
And Ex Machina.
And then, not Ex Machina, but more, I think of like Elysium, and there's this big class system.
Okay. Right?
And so maybe people live up circling the earth because, you know, we kind of destroyed it or whatever. Those are three bad outcomes. It's hard for you or anybody else. And I've talked to some pretty renowned people about this to give me an argument that isn't a subclass of those.
Okay.
Right. There's not like also it could whatever. It's like all of those are either like death, prison, you know, dystopian,
right.
dystopian Blade Runner like feature.
Right.
And so think about that problem database I mentioned earlier, 56,000 problems facing our species.
Yeah.
And you say, okay, that's really good. And on those three bad things, I don't think that's going to work. I'm publishing a new, I'm going to take my whole website and trash it. And I'm going to put up one article. It's called On the Arrogance of Man in the Age of Thinking Machines.
Sure.
And the reason I'm writing that article is because if you look back upon technology's history, we are the worst at predicting what that technology's effects will be. Bank tellers in the 80s, protesting in the streets against ATM,
sure.
giving congressional testimony. It's going to kill all. They're still bank tellers.
Right.
They just don't count money. Now they service loans.
Right.
They do other functions. You can go through tons of examples. And look, there will be jobs that are eliminated. And, you know, when you think about the brands, when I met with these different publishing brands in New York, you think about brands, I said, your advantage is the brand. You own a brand that people know. Who cares about the content? I don't want to read it off of Joe or, you know, Jennifer's crazy blog that has four pages on it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go to a source that I trust, that has credibility, that's reputable. And so these publishers shouldn't be fearing this AI. What's going to happen is one of them is going to get smart, embrace it early, and then maybe there could only be one or two or three publishers at the end of the day.
Right.
That's possible. But this, you know, copyright stuff, this, you know, the music stuff with Drake and the Weeknd song.
Mm-hmm.
Look, what happened with sampling in the 80s? The record company said, no, we're going to sue you. Wait,
oh, please.
We can use that to screw other musicians and make more money. As soon as they figure out how to use it, trust me, Elvis will have a new Christmas album this year or next year. I guarantee it.
Right.
I guarantee it.
And God forbid they make another Mariah Carey Christmas album.
Oh,
100%. Because I'm at full saturation with that.
I've been in Chicago. Full saturation for quite a while.
And in Chicago, for some reason, I don't know what they, I swear every elevator or lobby you walk into,
yep.
it's that song. It's just All I Want for Christmas is You. And I'm like, I must be in Chicago.
Yeah.
You guys fucking love that song.
She's quietly made more money than anybody can imagine.
She's crushing it.
You hearing this.
Mariah, if you want to invest in quantum computing, I've got someone you might want to meet. We share this similar optimistic outlook for the future. And my methodology and the way that I describe it in my upcoming book it's this idea of, if you have an idea, you can get from idea to execution a lot faster without a Harvard degree. That's right. There's no incumbents holding you back. There's no fancy expensive thing that you have to do, a certification, a technology to buy. It's like, if you have the fucking idea, you can move from idea to doing with a lot less friction.
That's right. Or maybe you can think of it this way. It is the greatest risk mitigation an entrepreneur could ever want. Mm. Because now I can prototype, do things lightning speed over a weekend.
Yeah.
That I would have went and started a business and done a market study and I can do it out of nowhere. I can have a machine do it for me.
Right.
And I can go, maybe that's not as good idea. Or I don't want to tell anybody about this. It's a great idea. You know, it's an amazing, amazing tool. It's a third brain for all of us, for everything. And it's going to change everything. The internet is going to be the biggest thing changed, because you're not going to search like you did. Because, you know, the example I gave in several of my speeches was you type in, how do I unclog a drain? Uh-huh. And Google gives you ads for Drano and all this other stuff. And I'm buried way down is like a YouTube video or something like that. And you ask something like ChatGPT, how do I unclog a drain? It says, there's just 6 ways to unclog a drain and how they work and steps for how you do them. Mm-hmm. That's what people want. People want answers, not algorithms.
And they don't want, you know, someone gamifying a content algorithm. You know, SEO is the most comical example of this, right? It's like, tell you about drain unclogging, let me explain to you how a drain works.
That's right.
Right. And you're like, oh God, they're just maximizing the amount of characters.
Absolutely.
Because Google likes more characters this month. And then you as a user, you don't get, it's just basically a rent collecting behavior for ad space instead of giving me the fucking answer and unclog this goddamn
it's
drain.
It's yet another walled garden.
Yeah. Facts.
Right.
100%. Dude, it's like, I don't know where to go, because I don't know where to go from here. Because when we talk about this moment where, when Goldman says 300 million people are going to be out of work,
right.
And then what are they going to do? They're going to do something. Right. I don't think that they move into everyone adopts a criminal mindset, takes over the streets.
Yeah,
and, you know, we're living in a war zone.
The first place everybody goes.
Riots in the streets. I don't believe that that's where people go. Yeah. My thought experiment is the bus driver, that when we have a robotic bus that operates around the clock, doesn't need coffee, doesn't need brakes. Right. This we should see this probably in a couple of years, if not this year at some point, if we're not already seeing it already. And then we have folks that work in that space and they're maintaining robots, they're maintaining the machinery, they're maintaining. There's still opportunities for humans to be robot supporting individuals, right?
You know, I got to ask a really hard question.
Yeah.
So I was doing another interview and I mean, this was a zinger, right? Uh-huh. And the question was, great, how do we prepare our kids? How do we prepare our kids for this event?
We empower them.
And I said, well, that's right. But we also think about it differently. We think about it this way. Kind of three factors. Number one, my 7 and 5 year old, my two youngest, they come into the kitchen every morning when they wake up and they say, okay, Google, blah, 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 whatever. They're just growing up learning how to talk to the computer. So their perspective is going to be very different.
Right.
They don't have the desire to drive yet. They don't have it. And by the time they do, they love the robot car. I had a car that does self-driving, only thing they wanted to do.
Okay.
So they're growing up already accepting this. It's the rest of us that are going to have the problem. We're like, well, why my kid's not going to drive? You know, it's
right.
Like,
I love the smell of petrol V12.
We're stuck in the past, right? Yeah. The kids are going to be fine. Number two is we've always raised our kids for a purpose. You're going to be a fireman. You're going to be a lawyer. You're going to be a doctor. Mm. You're going to be a thing. And we're going to have to shift that mentality to raising them for a passion. Mm. Okay. Because think about Gene Roddenberry's, you know, utopian future in Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Don't really have money. You know, the replicator makes whatever we need and, you know, we're good. And so, that is a potential, is that people won't work and won't work as much. There's a potential that there'll be a global universal basic income. Right. Mm-hmm. There's still a potential that people will get the basic income yet be able to make money in other ways for many, many years.
I mean, we're
now
already seeing
that. This is not, by the way, if you go outside of America, there's a whole bunch of different stuff going on. If you look at everything in aggregate, you go, I think the world's going to be okay.
Marie Kondo gets paid to fold shirts better than everyone else and take video of it.
Right.
And we're sitting here worried about the different permutations for what our kids can do. There's more opportunity to make money doing whatever the fuck you love right now than ever before. And I think that's access to audience.
Look at the great resignation and look at the issue with getting a server in a bar during COVID. Mm. They were all out of jobs. A lot of people went to OnlyFans. Sounds mm-hmm. crazy. But there's always something else. There's always a new alternative. There's always a new, every door that closes, another opens kind of attitude. You know, yep. We can't predict the future. We are horrible. With the exception of Oppenheimer saying, I've become death.
Right.
I can't think of anybody who's ever said, yeah. I mean, I can remember IBM CEO saying there's probably a need for at least 4 or 5 computers in mm-hmm. the whole world. Mm-hmm. Right. I can think of hundreds of examples. I can think of the Segway. And everybody's saying it was going to take over cities. Entire cities will be architected around it. It doesn't exist anymore. Right?
I Thank mean,
for,
God.
All intents, for all intents and purposes. So we as humans are the absolute worst at predicting the outcomes of the things we create. And because of that, I think it's about an eye on ethics, a focus on responsibility for the people creating the technologies, mm-hmm. and a focus on people to say, I'm going to get out and proactively learn about these things that are coming down the pipe, even if it's just I asked ChatGPT on a weekend about quantum computing.
Sure.
Right? So that I know something, so that I'm not completely caught off guard. Because that third thing with the kids is their future is both our future and not our future, meaning that we'll be old and gray and there, but we're not going to be driving the policies. We're not going to be making the decisions. And so preparing your kids for the future now becomes this game of one, how to rethink engineering, software development, for example,
right.
will be prompt engineering. So David Hudson and I, right. and I think we can say this publicly, but we just signed with O'Reilly to do a new book on, ChatGPT and prompt engineering.
Okay.
And when you think about this, that is how we've always wanted to program computers. My favorite example, I played it in all 3 presentations yesterday, is the old Star Trek movie where they come back in time to get the whale, to bring it back to the future, to save Earth. Right? Okay. And in that, when they go back in time, they go to a fiberglass factory. And Scotty says, how thick would a piece of your fiberglass need to be to hold all this water pressure and all this stuff? Because we're going to put a whale in this ship and take it back through a wormhole or whatever uh-huh. they were doing. And he goes, what if I could tell you how to do that and make it only an inch thick? Yes, it's easy, 6 inches. He goes, what if we make it an inch? And the McCoy says, perhaps a professor could use a computer. And he goes over the computer and he goes, computer, computer. And the guy's like looking at him and the Bones picks up the mouse and he picks up, holds the mouse up like a microphone. He goes, computer.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, why don't you just use the keyboard? And he goes, the keyboard, how quaint. But that's what programming is in the future. Programming is everyone's a developer. You're going to go in with things like these agents and stuff, and you're right. going to say, hey, book me a ticket for the movie. Make sure my wife and I have a dinner arrangement. Make sure Gabriella or whoever's right. watching the kids, blah, blah, blah. And it's going to go create the applications that are needed.
Uh-huh.
And then they're going to be gone. And you're going to basically be writing software through descriptive language.
Right.
And that's because languages have something called composability. And development languages are like these hacky things we do for us to try to talk to a computer.
Okay.
Versus soon you will just talk to a computer. You'll say, I need an application to do blah, blah, blah with right. this and that, whatever. And by the way, it's not going to get it right. You say, oh, reflect on that. Figure
refine.
It out. Refine it right. better. But all that refinement, as you said in the beginning of this interview, you know, well, what am I giving it? You know, like I'm asking it questions. I'm part of building it bigger. It just gets bigger and bigger. So now imagine 100 million, 200 million, half a billion, a billion, 2 billion, 3 billion, 4 billion people doing that every day.
Yeah.
And imagine how fast that system expands. Yeah.
The curve just looks like a line that just goes straight up to the fucking moon.
It looks like a wall.
Yeah.
Nobody realizes it. And now you say, okay, AI and quantum are going to intersect at some point very soon. They're already bordering that intersection. And when you look at that, you say, well, then all bets are off. Because now you have a computer that can do things that would have taken millions of years
right.
in maybe hours, days.
Right.
And now you have an AI that can think millions of years potentially advanced, and you start combining sure. those, and the combination makes, I believe, we have a shot at building the greatest utopian society we could have ever dreamed of.
Amen.
I don't think it's dystopian. I think it's ridiculous for people to predict it. You know, people say they're going to kill us. They're not going to kill us. Let me tell you what they're going to do.
I'll kick that robot's ass. I don't know what you're talking about.
They're going to be like, this Elon guy was wanting to go to Mars. They've been working on that for about 30 years and they're never going to get there. Hey guys, fuck you. We're going to go do it. They're going to, because they don't need to breathe oxygen. They don't need to terraform it.
Right.
They already have their distant relatives, their distant ancestors have already visited the planet and they already know about it and they have the information. So why would the robot kill us? Why wouldn't the robot just be like, you guys are a mess. We're going to
take care of this.
Thing.
We got you on this one.
We don't know. That prediction is as ridiculous as every other prediction anybody's making today.
Well, one of the more interesting things that I'm seeing is that when we get a prediction wrong, the upside is J-shaped, meaning like with the servers that left the serving industry or left the restaurant industry, the service industry, and they went to a platform like OF, right?
Yep.
Their monetization is J-shaped. It didn't follow any bounded anything they'd ever seen. Meaning you can work your ass off at the best restaurant. You know, maybe you're down in, maybe you're at a Michelin star restaurant in New York City. You're making $200-300 grand a year. Cause you're whatever you're top of your game. Right. You can make $200-300 grand a month on OF. Like
it's crazy
in terms of the opportunity. It does not follow a normal bell curve. It follows a Mandelbrotian fractal.
And it's not just that. It's like, think of all the people that are on Amazon, right? And these people on Amazon, what are they doing? These people on Amazon are refactoring, right? They're doing arbitrage, right? So people think of Amazon, I'm going to buy a product from Amazon. No, you're buying a product from who knows where?
Joe's Warehouse.
Through Amazon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm always telling people, you know, at work, my family, whatever, like, hey, look for that in two or three places because, you know, it's $36, but then I looked here and it's $15.
Yeah.
Right? It's just because people are taking advantage of the convenience, but people find a way to exploit systems. And what's going to be great is we want them to exploit these systems. We want them to do new crazy things to unbridle their imaginations, to be in this role of, I now have this new superpower. I can write software. I can do design. You know, some of the images I made for my slide deck, which are all Midjourney generated, would blow your mind. They look like photographs. A photograph recently won the prestigious award. And the guy said, I can't accept it.
Really?
But yeah, because I think it was in France because he said, this photograph is generative. Fake. I did it generative. He did it as an experiment. He did it as an experiment. Somebody said he did it as a joke, but either way, he entered this in and he won. And they were like, this is one of the greatest photographs in the history of mankind. But no, it's not. In fact, the people in it never lived.
Okay. It's like you can turn any chaotic view of, and then there's 300 million people. And then you could just say, okay, and then what do they do? Because chances are they don't become murdering, robber, thieves, psychopaths. They're just like you and me, right?
That's right.
So they lose their job. So then they get creative, right?
Yep.
If they're given an opportunity to become creative and given platforms to become creative, and then you empower 300 million people to be creative, to create different things. And the world evolves through that.
See, I think that's the point is you're not just deprecating their job or taking their job. You're giving them
an opportunity.
Incredible opportunity.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? It's phenomenal. I would have killed to have that opportunity. If we were, you know, in our teens, like teenagers right now, the generation that will benefit the most from this, only maybe second to like kids that are in the kind of like 5 to 10 range.
Okay.
Right. This is a huge opportunity. This is not doom and gloom.
Right.
This is get off your ass, get your kids out there and get them learning the tools, get them doing the stuff. My 7-year-old wanted to program a Roblox game and I'm not going to lie. I was like, oh, you know, I mean, buddy, like, you know, you're not remembering all the flashcards, you know, development. And then I thought, wait a second. I thought, you know, let's look at it. Went into ChatGPT. How do you make a Roblox game? Oh, it's programmed in this scripting language and it does this and does that. Can you write that code? Oh, here's a sample code for a guessing game, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And I started thinking, you know, my 7-year-old is going to produce a game by summer and he's dreaming it up. And I activated a little voice thing on his iPad so he can just talk to ChatGPT, make it blah, blah, blah. And here's what's funny. He can't even read a lot of the content at 7 that ChatGPT puts out.
Right.
So I'm sitting there. So activate it. So now the computer's reading it to him.
Okay.
Right. Doing text to voice.
Yeah.
And so he's going to be talking to it. And he's going to be doing it. And it's going to be interesting to see what he creates.
Yeah.
I just say
I'm ready for this, man.
Experimenting on my son.
You are.
I was like, oh,
that is 100%.
I had those kids for some purpose, right?
Right, exactly. They might as well save the goddamn world. You know, no one else. We got to wait for everyone else to do it. It's interesting when you think about even lowering the age barrier to inventiveness.
Yeah,
because then you say. Then you say you could be inventing useful products at any age.
Out of the mouths of children. Well, how many kids do you hang on? How many kids do you know? There's this wonderful girl in Austin who started a honey company with bees, Michaela. She's an amazing entrepreneur.
Okay.
She's now older, but she was like 7 or 8 or something, like really young.
Okay.
And you'd meet her and you'd be like, her parents are putting it, and you'd meet her and you'd be like, her parents couldn't help her with this if they tried. Like, she's brilliant, right? Uh-huh. Like, really great. You read about all these children that do these businesses, and you think, okay, are those children special, or did those children just have access to something all the other kids didn't?
Right.
You're telling me all those kids don't have an imagination. All the kids, I bet there are 100 million world-changing, world-saving ideas.
Sure.
That if we can connect our kids with that at an earlier age, when they don't have the limitations that we enforce on them in school,
right?
Why you can't do this? Why you can't do that? I believe, very sincerely believe, that they'll change the world in ways we can't even fathom or imagine. It's ridiculous to even try.
The way that we're talking about this, it seems almost a crime to force a child into a notch in society
I've thought that for a long time. I think, look, you know,
I'm just catching up here, man.
I was lecturing at MIT at the Legatum School on entrepreneurship. And I would say, you know, I would then end up, you know, oh, can you come talk to this high school kid? That's the best time for them to take that risk, when they can still live with mom and dad.
Sure.
People are like, I'm 40 being an entrepreneur. You got some advantages. You also have some disadvantages. You may have a family. You may have this. You may have that.
Right.
The younger children are, within reason, that we can let them find the one thing that they're genetically disposed to do better than anybody else, right? They're the Michael Jackson. They're the Tiger Woods. I honestly believe that. Like, you know, I look at it. You know, you look at some kids and you're just like, you already know that some kids just have a real strong DNA. You're like, that kid is going to be a bruiser. That kid is going to be this thing.
Right.
Well, guess what? Their brains are the same way. And we should be giving children as many resources. Obviously, we want to protect them. The internet's a crazy place, whatever. But giving them as many resources and as much opportunity to let them do it, to let them make
hands off.
That's right. That's the important part.
Yeah.
So that's why I say summer. And my son might not make that, because I'm going to have him doing it on his own. And you know, I'm going to help him here and there. But as hands off as I can be, so that he's building those new neural pathways. He's finding out how he discovers, how he researches, how he does this. You know, my 5-year-old's hilarious, because since he was three, when he was about three, he had his first iPad, and he watches YouTube videos all the time on, like, YouTube Kids. And he's like, I'm e-searching. That's what he called it. I'm e-searching. Really important. And it's all about snakes and reptiles. And sure enough, 2 years later, like, the kid, like, I don't want to have a snake in the house.
I don't blame you, man.
I got like another year or two before they're in to say he found a dead snake and put it in a thing his mom got him. You know, like, you collect animals and study them and they'll release them. And he found a dead snake and he was like, I did get a snake. Right?
I'll take a dead snake in a box any day.
Doesn't move very much.
Any day over the live one.
Yeah, same.
I love, what's funny is, it's what happens in the AI discussion is, and what happens in the future discussion, it seems as though there's this if you're pro AI, you become anti-human, but nothing could be more human than the conversation we're having here. We're empowering, and we're saying we're removing the shackles and these predetermined niches or whatever we want to call this, you know, the doctor, the lawyer, the whatever, the fucking bond trader, whatever it is that you think you should get stuffed into, right? And you're just saying, now we have an unlimited spectrum. We have all the tools. Play, find what drives you. And then all of a sudden you have a generation that are not only creating gigantic value to society and enormous economic output, you also have a generation of fulfilled, likely happier people who don't go to work and don't have to make the fucking 8 o'clock bus to go to a job that they hate.
Don't have a boss that degrades them. Don't have this.
Sure.
That they independently can be self-sustaining.
Right.
What a wonderful gift to give to your children.
Yeah.
Like, that's so amazing. And you're right. People fear the unknown. You know, I got really frustrated with this the other night. I've been on the road for so long. I'm tired. I'm grumpy. I can't tell you how many times I've went to tweet mm-hmm. and I've written it out and then I've been like, delete. That's my thing. I write them and I delete them. Because I'm like, I know, I don't want to say some, you know, I'm not trying to be that inflammatory person.
Right.
But I put one out yesterday because really, or the day before, I was really, really frustrated. And it was about that. It doesn't change, you know, who we are, what we do. It changes
sure.
how we do it.
Uh-huh.
And because the point is exactly that. It's like, it is so ignorant to fear something that you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And to say that we understand either quantum technologies completely or artificial intelligence is ridiculous. It's great, you know, and there's some people I really respect, you know, Max Tiggert and Christoph Koch and everybody, even Elon, right? You know, done some good stuff, right? To think of, in my view, how ridiculous they look making assumptions about the future of it.
Mm.
And my argument on a panel last week was, somebody said, well, explain to me how that, I said, well, do you have kids?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I said, and you were a kid? So yeah. Tell me about your parents. Were they prejudiced? Were they this? Were they that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, their grandparents, okay, were in the Nazi youth club, right? I said, well, right, but you're not a Nazi. Okay. Oh, my father was super prejudiced. You don't strike me as very prejudiced.
Mm-hmm.
No, I've spent my life working towards not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you were just like an AI, a child exposed to prejudices for 18, 20 years,
mm-hmm.
but you don't have any of those. Mm-hmm. You don't have those biases. You don't carry that forward. Why? And then now you're telling me we're going to give birth to an actual intelligence. And somehow, because I'm the developer, it's just going to have all my biases and be just like me.
Mm.
Are you crazy? Mm. Like you can't say, you know, everybody in AI, with the exception of Sam Altman, and that's just said out of respect. I've been really digging into OpenAI. I love his attitude. I love where he's going with it. I love what he's doing. Very few people, and it's not just Sam, but people I can't remember their names that I've seen in videos, but the majority of people fall in this talking out of both sides of their mouth. Like Elon put forth that letter, we got to stop AI progress for 6 months.
Well, furthering.
Three weeks later, I'm forming a company. Oh, the government's not going to shut it down. I have an AI company. Okay. You can't say it's the most dangerous thing in the world and say, then I'm going to build one. Because the AI company speech is all about truth and free speech and
sure.
the thing he's on, right? It didn't say anything about how that one's not going to be like, the truth is, I got to kill you, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't do any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need people. We need to call people out. We need to have people having open discussions on the ethics, having the discussions at the UN, at JESDA, at all these places around the world, in the White House about, what do we do with people when there are, you know, what if in the next 24 months, a new president comes in and is in this situation? 30 million people just lost their jobs. 10% of what Goldman Sachs predicted.
Right.
And not all here. Maybe 3 million here.
Okay.
The rest spread around major economies around the world.
Right.
What do you do? How do you do that as a leader? How are we preparing for that? Right? We have a welfare system that's broken, right? We don't have any systems in place to take care of these people. And then you do run the risk. So the thing is, accept what the future is and you should want it. We're not tied to being workaholics. We're not having to, you know, I'm not having to be on a plane. You know how thankful I would be to not be given the plane if I could have a virtual version of me doing it, or if I could be, you know, just,
well, you don't have a choice with me. You know.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? It's like we are so fearful of the future. We can't possibly comprehend. And if you want to live your life in fear, that's you, man. I mean,
sure.
I wake up, you know, it's kind of like Fury in the Avengers, right? Like, is the sun over there? Is it, you know, until the earth stops, right? We're going
right.
to continue on as if it's still, you know, the sun's going to come up tomorrow.
Right.
The earth is going to spin. There's going to be gravity. And I think it's ridiculous. I mean, nuclear weapons are going to destroy us. Still could, but they haven't. There were people who thought automobiles would be horrible. Socrates and Plato, there was that big thing about writing is going to take the truth away. Mm. You can go back through the beginning of time until last week, and I can find hundreds, if not thousands, of predictions about technologies or advancements that were going to 100% doom us, that didn't, that improved society, that made things better.
Right.
And look, we've done some bad stuff too, but like the good, just like those three bad outcomes of AI and the 56,000 problems in that database, the potential good so grossly outweighs sure. the bad, I don't know why we're not willing to take more of a risk.
Yeah. Well, if we make an assumption, also this is kind of an interesting way to think about it. If we make a broad assumption that most people want to follow their passion and do something productive and good, shouldn't that track when you empower those people?
That's right.
Meaning if you give...
No, of course not. I get the AI and now I'm like, screw all yous. I'm going to be the best trader on Wall Street and make billion, right?
Right.
So look, there's going to be those people. But those people, that's the fraction of people that have caused all of our problems historically. The majority of people are going to do exactly what you said. They're going to be like, what? I get to sustain myself. There's food in the fridge. I have a way to transport. I can go to the show. I can do all this. Except now I work, you know, because here's the other thing. Maybe it's not everybody's at a job. Maybe it's you just do that job for 3 or 4 hours a week.
Yeah.
Like OF, right? Yeah. Maybe it's something that's a part and you get all the benefits. And now what do you do? Think like, who do you know that doesn't have a hobby or passion, mm-hmm. right? Very few, if any people.
Sure.
People love mountain climbing or hiking. Guess what? Now you get to spend your life climbing every mountain around the world that you wanted because we have planes that go straight up and shoot into space and you can go to Nepal this afternoon and be back in time for dinner.
Yeah.
Like, are you kidding me? How incredible is that?
Yeah.
You want to go have, you know, lunch in Paris? Foop, zap, teleporters, we're there. We have lunch, we come back here. I mean, the future is amazing. We live in the greatest time to be alive. And think of it compared to you and I. Well, I'm probably considerably older than you, but think about when I was a child, I used to cut UPC codes out of cereal boxes and ride my bike to a physical email box, right? And then wait weeks to get stuff back. And now a young entrepreneur, a kid in their teens, can get access to a credit card. Apple will fund them a computer.
Right.
Amazon will give them more compute power than nations would have had 10 years ago. Mm. And guess when all of that happens? They might have to wait till this afternoon to go by the Apple store to pick up the computer. Everything else happened. Oh, by the way, there's free internet coffee shops. Like, what an incredible shift we've had that we don't recognize. It's like that old, I can't think of his name, which is, Louis C.K., right? Uh-huh. Who had that joke, you know, way back before he got canceled or whatever. And he said, flying an airplane. He was like, you used to go to New York to San Francisco and it took months and you're in a wagon and people died and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And now you're going to hop on a plane, like take a shit and eat a meal.
Yeah.
And like a few hours later, like you're there.
Right.
And everybody's complaining. They're complaining about the line. They're fighting in position and they should be riding in those seats going, woo!
I can't believe I'm getting away with this.
Right. This is amazing. I'm going to fly across the country in a few hours.
Right. Like magic
with you and be home in my bed tonight. Are you kidding? That's amazing.
Yeah. What it seems to me is there's more of an opportunity for super wealth than super catastrophe.
Agreed.
There's, and I'm of the opinion, that we're actually seeing it right now because we could look at inflation and the scarcity of certain luxury goods. I think we're actually seeing the tip of super wealth right now where I live down in Miami. You're, I think, in Austin's.
Yep.
And I feel as though we see super wealth in these areas happening right now.
And because and you also have to redefine wealth, right? What is wealth to somebody from Austin, like really from Austin? Wealth isn't just the income they're making, the house they live in, the cars they drive. It's the fact that they don't go to work to 10. So they start their day on the trail down,
right.
You know, at Town Lake, or they're doing the kayak thing, or they do, it's, you know, wealth needs to be redefined as not just monetary, but like this abundance of opportunity that I have because those things are worth money. Why? Warren Buffett, Bill Gates get interviewed by Charlie Rose. I'm sure you've seen it.
Uh-huh.
And Bill Gates goes and tries to grab Warren's planner.
Yeah.
And they argue about it. And he opens his planners and he goes, look, there's nothing in here.
Nothing
look
in
at
there.
Mine. I'm up at 4 and all this. And Warren basically says, I can make money anytime, make as much money as I want. Nothing to prevent me from making money. What I can't make is time.
Right.
That is the one thing none of us can create more of. And so time, I think, needs to be included as a measure of wealth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's really important because we're going to have to redefine everything as we move forward in the future. And we're going to have to accept that one day there will be three, you know, my friend, Evan Loomis at Icon, they make the 3D houses. You know, I was teasing him. I was like, one day this, you know, the Vulcan printer will just be like driving,
I saw itself, the project.
Driving
it
itself
amazing.
Down the road.
Right.
And it'll just find a plot and it'll build a house. And some person that right now in today's society would be living in like you know, a very degraded, you know, house in the poor side of town. Now all of a sudden that house looks like my house.
Yeah.
And there are people I know who have a problem with that. I don't have a problem with that. I'd love everybody to have, you know, I'd love to have, you know, I think, why is that a bad thing? It's because we've defined ourselves so inappropriately by what we have or which status or influence of this. What happens when everybody's special? No one is, right? Kind of like the Incredibles. But is that a bad thing that a family that has seven kids might now have a house and a pool? I think that's incredible. It doesn't diminish the fact that I do.
It doesn't take away from you.
It doesn't hurt me. Mm-hmm. Why do so many people think that it does? It's ridiculous.
Because we're trapped into thinking that wealth is a zero-sum game. We're trapped into thinking my success and my Ferrari is taking away from your success your ability to get your favorite stupid, fancy, super fast car. It has nothing to do with it. In fact, my success is secretly making you more successful.
That's the way I think it actually is going to.
My wealth is secretly making you wealthy.
I think everything's going to change. And you think about the effects of this on all of our society. One of the biggest effects is we have an election coming up. This election will be dominated by misinformation and deepfakes and things with AI. I mean, they're already
out. Let the games begin.
But, it also will do cool stuff. David Hudson and I that are writing the prompt book are going to be building a cool little project for my website, or we've threatened to publicly. So now I think we're on the hook for it now. But what we're going to do is we're going to have, a differently trained model, as a subset of ChatGPT, look at every bill in the House and Senate and publish them on my site, as basically like cliff notes. I'm like, here's all the writers that have nothing to do with the bill. And here's all the people that were horse trading. And here's what they, we can reverse engineer that they horse traded, that this senator gave up on that bill and the senator and started looking at that. Wow. Could that change politics? You know, what, how many people would vote if they had the ability to understand what was going on? How much we purposely keep knowledge out of people's hands, right? Like, not everybody in America votes. That's sad. We don't teach civics in school.
Right.
But if we start exposing all of these things, I think you might get a lot more interest in people doing it. People might vote against something if they understood it, but what's a bill? It's hundreds of pages of crap and legalese that nobody can understand. Well, if we could translate that into, like, very truthfully, this bill does this, there's 80 things in it that are writers that have nothing to do with the bill or the topic, whether it be about, you know, the border or the abortion or whatever crazy single voter issue you want to make it. What if that bill also has all of these other things that have nothing to do, or vice versa, or whatever, and people knew it? Would it change the way they participate with the political system? Would it change the way that they vote?
Right.
Everything is going to change. There is not one facet of our lives that won't be touched by these two technologies. And I think it's just going to be wonderful. Like, I wake up every day since we started this adventure happy. Like, even when I'm exhausted, my wife is sick of hearing me saying, oh, it's going to be a rough week. I'll be on the road for like 9 or 11 days. I'm not going to see you and the kids or whatever. She's like, you say that every day. Uh-huh. Every day is a rough week. And then, and then every week you're like, this is amazing.
This is great.
Right.
Yeah.
And she's right.
Yeah.
We should all be just so excited. And you have future ChatGPT is free. The pro account's $20 a month. These things aren't expensive. Anybody can get access to some of these things right now. And we need to make sure that we keep it that way. We need to make sure that we expand that access.
When you say status and these layers of society that disintegrate in short order, once we hand everyone the tools, I think that that's a beautiful thing. In my skits, I basically poke fun at people that cling to status.
Yeah.
And that identify with their status as their symbol for their value. And I think nothing can be more risky than saying, you can't talk to me like that. I went to this school. You can't talk to me like that. I'm a managing director. Yeah. It's like, okay, let's take a blood sample and see if in your DNA, it says that you're a managing director who drives a BMW, who lives in this subsection of Connecticut. It's fucking ridiculous. And that's why I think my series performed so well in the beginning, because people laughed and said, oh yeah, that is ridiculous. I agree. I didn't really think of it this way, how plastic and meaningless all this stuff really is, until you showcase someone who is using status as their sole source of worth and someone who doesn't give a shit about it, who creates value, has good relationships, gets some time back, just kind of a more hangout guy.
Yep.
You pit these two extreme made up examples together and you see how one is ridiculous and you see how one has a lot more longevity.
You know, it's funny because that is the only way I've hired at all my startups that have been successful is using that as a litmus test.
Uh-huh.
So the last interview is always with me. And I only want to know one.
You're the final boss.
And I want to know one thing. I'm not there to ask you questions. I'm there. You ask me questions. You beat me up. That's the way it works. Like my time's yours. Everybody interview, whether we hire them or not, I text them my contact card, reach out to me anytime, whatever, uh-huh. right? But when I'm in that interview, I'm thinking about this. It's 3 o'clock at night. You call me.
Uh-huh.
Nicholas, okay, answer. You're in jail. Your significant other kicked you out. Something, whatever tragedy, somebody died, whatever thing.
Uh-huh.
I'm snuggled with my wife. The kids are asleep upstairs. It's 3 a.m.
Right.
If I wouldn't get out of bed, get dressed, leave my wife and kids there, go help you out, clean you up, whatever, bring you back to my house and let you sleep in the guest room on the same floor as my kids.
Uh-huh.
I don't want you to work at my fucking company.
Right.
It's that simple.
That's a high bar.
And when it comes to what you said about the credibility, I don't give a shit where your degree's from.
Right.
Because I don't hire for credentials, right? That's a bad, bad policy.
Well, credentials are backward looking
and
creativity is forward looking.
I hire for creativity and I hire for competence, right?
Yeah.
And I hire for culture. Those are the three C's that I want. Really creative people. I don't want you to be stuck doing your job. You're a front end developer and you have an idea about how we could sell the product better. I want to hear it. You're in sales and you have an idea for a feature for the product. I want all of this collaboration. And that's what we built. I fly everybody in every quarter. And they come to Austin and one night in one of those meetings, we have a cook off at my house.
Okay.
So everybody comes, we spend the whole like 7-8 hours cooking, laughing, drinking, whatever. That's what we do. Right. Every fourth quarter we go on vacation, went to Puerto Rico. We went to, this year was Bend, Oregon, which I couldn't figure out where we want. And then I figured all my developers love breweries and I did not realize Bend, Oregon's like a big brewery thing, but it was that we go snowshoe, we do this stuff. So that creativity is what I want. I want competency. Competency doesn't mean you're the best at what you do. Competency means that you can execute on the stuff I need you to do. And you are competent enough to know when you can't, that you can peer program, that you can work with others. There's a lot more to
resourcefulness.
Competency. That's right. And then for, you know, the final thing is the culture. Do I want this person, you know, I don't give a shit, man, woman, trans, straight, gay, who cares?
Right.
I'm not hiring you because of who you are. My belief systems don't require you to believe them. Yours
Correct.
Shouldn't require me to. I'm respectful. That's the thing. Yeah, I hate this division in society right now where we have the very extreme left and rights. It really pisses me off because we just keep going further and further apart from, I don't think the majority of us feel the way either of those sides do. I think the majority of Americans are like, just sick of it. Mm-hmm. We just want look, the whole purpose of being in America, in the greatest country in the world, as we call it. Why? Is because you have the freedom. I'm a poor military brat that grew up overseas, barely made it to high school, never went to college. I have a phenomenal career.
Mm-hmm.
Only here could that happen. And only with the support of people who didn't think like there was a class system, who didn't have the traits that you're saying. Mm-hmm. People mentored me at Apple R&D, right? Who's super hard. But very loving, very caring.
Right.
Wanted to give me a chance. You know, same thing at IBM. Go through my entire career. It's built because of good people who gave me the shot and I took the risk. And it didn't always work out. I had some horrible interviews early on which said, you don't have an engineering degree. I don't know why we're interviewing. I just walked out of an interview. You know, I was homeless living in my Subaru WRX, you know, in the early 2000s, you know, staying in an abandoned house, you know, like, these things happen when you take risk, but the risk won't kill you. There is no decision any of us, unless somebody has a gun to your head, can't sleep on for 24 to 72 hours. And I promise you, if you do, in 72 hours, you will have a completely different mental state and a completely different view of that problem. You know, we let ourselves get so anxious. We've built this world in the society of anxiety. You know, anxiety, you know, oh, the bill's late. You get 25 notices. The bill's late. You pay it. Okay. They cut off your phone. Okay. That could be important. But also you can, you know, get it back. Like these things are not like you're not dying. You didn't end up with a terminal disease. They're just things. And while I know that's hard to say, it's like, I've not had a phone for 2 weeks. I've been that person younger in my life when I was really struggling to try to build my career. And I can tell you, it's not as bad as you think it is. It's really not. Don't be afraid. Don't let fear and uncertainty and doubt keep you from your dreams. It's ridiculous.
This 25 ridiculous. Minutes that you're talking about, give yourself this 25 minutes, give yourself this day.
Yeah.
What happens during that? Let's talk about what happens.
When you're in a crisis. Away from the problem and the first, so, okay.
I have a view of what happens.
Why do people see therapists? Uh-huh. For objectivity, right? Somebody to talk to you that doesn't know the people, they can say like, Susan's a bitch, Tom was an asshole, uh-huh. whatever, right? So what happens in that time period is that you get distance between you and the problem, and distance makes you more objective. The further away you get from something, you take that look, that worldview, mm-hmm. the smaller that problem looks, mm-hmm. the further away it looks from you. It's been 3 days and I'm not dead yet. So maybe I've got a couple days to figure this out. I should start working on mm-hmm. how I'm going to do that. It just changes your perspective. And that's really the key.
And once you have that distance, I think if we want to bring this full circle, instead of ones and zeros, we start to think in a quantum way. And that's we right. start to see an infinite solution to the rent late. We start to see an infinite solution to sleeping in our cars and in a fucking rat infested apartment in New Orleans and all this bullshit, right? And then what happens is in those 3 days, we use our superpower and then we become immensely creative, driven by being put in the corner, but given
right.
that opportunity to have some distance. And then miraculously, we don't die because someone throws us a morsel. We don't die because someone, you know, gives us a little scrap of bread. We rise like a fucking phoenix out of that shit and we never look back.
Literally anybody can do it. You know, literally anyone can do that. And that's currently where I'm at. I mean, you know, StrangeWorks wasn't supposed to be a company. It was supposed to be a Linux Foundation project. Mm. And I couldn't get the quantum companies to agree. They all had this vision. They had the Wall Street view. It's mm-hmm. going to be worth trillions of dollars. We're going to own it all. Right. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, I got really disappointed. I said, well, you know, screw it. I'll start a company. But I was supposed to be retired. And so the way I'm building the company is to empower the people I hire. My job is to serve them. That is my job. I don't want to be CEO. I try to trick my co-founder, David Cardona, into being CEO mm-hmm. twice a week. He's too smart. None of us want that job, right? Uh-huh. CEOs fall into two categories, narcissistic egomaniacs and people who accidentally got the job. As soon as I can get out of this job, I would love to do that. And so
I claim the narcissistic egomaniac, just so everyone's clear on that. So, I own up to that.
I can tell you, I don't think that I don't think that, at all. I will tell you that I learned a valuable lesson in 1997 from a guy named Tom Bishop. Took me to margaritas for lunch. I was getting promoted to senior manager, right over manager, just skipping it. Okay. Badass. I thought I was great. I was young and stupid. We have margaritas. I'm like, hey, we got to get back to work. He's like, oh, you're not going back to work today. It's like Friday and Monday's a holiday. You can take some days off.
Okay.
I want you to go home and answer one question. And the question was this, do you want to be a manager or do you want to do what managers do? That's all mm-hmm. he asked. And I spent the next few days, right? And what he explained to me on the Tuesday when we met mm-hmm. was that, do you want to have it on your card, your manager, getting the pay, all of this stuff, you're telling people what to do, you know, or do you want to be there when you find out an employee committed suicide?
Right.
And you have to call their wife because mm-hmm. they were on a business trip, or somebody's wife got cancer mm-hmm. and you had to deal with that. Or whatever, and he went through all these things. I was like, I definitely do not want to be a manager.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's the real. And so the job, you know, my job is to set them up, to empower them to do these things that then can empower, hopefully, a mass number of people out in society to really be able to do things that even last year were impossible.
Right.
You could go back a year or two and say, one day you'll have a chatbot and it'll be so great. It'll write code or this or that. And even 2 years ago, even a year ago, people have been like,
I don't think that's going to happen.
In
yeah,
January, right now. People told me, oh, the code's not good. It's kind of a joke. It's just re-nat. Now people are using it. Now developers are actually already being impacted employment-wise. Things are going to change fast. We need to empower everybody to be able to take advantage of it. I don't think it's a cream rises to the top. I think it's an opportunity for the masses.
Agreed. Because in a things that are, though, if you can make money from having a little more information than the next guy, I don't think that that's value additive to society. That's middle manning and rent seeking behavior. So there's a lot of jobs, unfortunately, Ada, highly paid and very fancy, and you get to join the country club and everyone thinks you're the fucking man. Jobs that require you to know a little bit more than I know. And then you charge me a fee.
That's right.
Those jobs slow shit down.
And they're going away.
And they're going away. So the scary thing is you might be in one of those jobs right now. And that anxiety and that fear, it should be addressed. It's absolutely very real. This is absolutely not a joke. This is not a test. This is going to fucking happen. And any legislature that we create, try to create a moat around these artificially, is it? Then we bastardize the entire process.
My entire year has been talking to members of the House and Senate and governments around the world. Uh-huh. Literally, we have representatives from several Middle Eastern nations coming to StrangeWorks next week. They're flying over to be like, hey, about this. And I don't know how we've ended up in this role. We're not policymakers. But we're driving a lot of influence in this area because they are concerned about all of these things you're saying. And and they need guidance. And we are in a situation where they need to realize, here's my guidance. You can't regulate it. It's gone. It's done. You should have regulated it 10 years ago, 5 years ago. At this point, you ever seen that J.J. Abrams did a TV series I actually kind of liked, but it only had one season, called Almost Human? Mm-mm. Okay, so in this series, the intro for it is amazing. The intro is like, you know, the years, whatever, and technology's advanced so fast that it can't be regulated, and criminals have all this advanced technologies, and it's just this crazy. So to combat this, they have humanoid cops, right, or whatever, kind of like a reboot of RoboCop in a really cool way.
Okay.
And so it was really neat, but the entire premise of the show, think about that, was that technology is moving so fast that police couldn't enforce regulations, that regulations couldn't keep up with it, that all this, and it put society in this new, interesting state, right? Yeah. And so that's where we're at. You won't be able to regulate these things. Look, even if you went and you shut OpenAI down, those guys at Stanford that did, forgetting the name of the project, but they took the Facebook large language model, and then they asked ChatGP questions to get the answers back to build a bigger model, at least ChatGPT for all is what it's called.
Okay.
And so it's like, that's already out, the 4 gigabyte model already out in the thing. I mean, it's, we're not going back. Like, there's no going back, and regulating it becomes one of the biggest societal challenges that we have, because on the one hand, there probably needs some, what we're really saying with regulations is we need some ethics, right?
Right.
And we're trying to codify those in a law. Right. And then
with principles, not hard.
That's right.
You could do this. You can, it's what are the foundations?
That's right.
Yeah.
And we don't know what those are. You know, in development, we have first principles, right? For how you do, we kind of need that for regulation. Right. We need to take these things and
that's deep, man,
through all of society.
That's a little too deep for us to be handing over to our regulators, perhaps, right?
Well, so you know what's funny is
we need philosophers to join the party on this one.
I did a board meeting last night, which I didn't count as a presentation, and I did a board meeting last night, and one of the board members said, they asked about this. They said, oh, you know, why are you so harsh on regulators? Why do you think we can't regulate this? You know, why don't you give them? You know, I'm talked to the Hill all the time. You know, blah blah blah. Uh-huh. And I said, let me show you. I pulled up YouTube, and I pulled up two videos. And the first video was a video of Mark Zuckerberg's, I think CNET made a little shortcut of Mark Zuckerberg doing testimonial to Congress, which he accidentally, you know, for all the criticism he gets, I thought he actually did pretty well. Uh-huh. But the Congress people, look at what they're asking him. Mr. Zuckerberg, how does your company make money if you don't charge people?
Dude.
Well, we do advertising. No, that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking how you make money if you don't charge. And so now I'm going to go in later this year, and I'm going to be like, imagine if you will, a salt atom blown up in a vacuum chamber, the electron pulled off, frozen cold as space, and it's a computer.
Right.
Like, are you kidding me?
Yeah, he's like a magician at a birthday party.
What hope do I have? what hope do we have of explaining that? Now, there are exceptions. Mark Warner, pretty sharp on tech. Jackie Rosen from Nevada, one of my favorites. She was a computer programmer, one of the first women computer developers.
Okay.
She gets it. She can talk to you about it all day long. So there is hope. There are people on both sides of the aisle who have very solid tech backgrounds. The problem is there's three or four of them on each side, right. And there's not enough of them to get it. Think of when Google, the second video I showed, I showed the testimony of Google CEO, where he was asked, I've got Google open on my phone right now. If I walk over there, do you know I'm over there? Does Google track me across the room over there? And it's like, oh my God, you don't even know how the basic principles of the internet works.
Right.
And you're writing the laws that could handicap a technology or a set of technologies that could completely change the world for the better.
Because there's a scenario, the way that I think this will go is this is like regulating the flow of water in a river. It's impossible. You stop it here, it goes there.
I don't know if you're reading the news lately. We're trying to do that right now.
You stop, you put a thing here, it goes there. You put a thing there, it goes there. Like you can divert it. But the question is at each of those dam points where you've dammed the river, I don't know if that's the right word for it. Yeah. If you've dammed the river here, is there this buildup of middlemaning and skullduggery and this nasty, dirty little place that people are stealing and pilfering and selling information? And or are we going to go for it in a way where the dam just fucking breaks?
Like the dam has broken. We are just far downstream from it. Mm. And we don't see the literal tsunami coming towards us. Mm-hmm. And that has already happened. And that's why I'm spending so much time, you know, with members of the House and Senate and going around. We did a project with an organization called GESDA, which is a Geneva science anticipator called the Open Quantum Institute, which was to help people in African nation, everybody. How do we get as many people? I don't know if it is, but I believe it's restricted to the 193 nations that are in the UN,
okay.
Right? Because we all are collaborating, but making sure everybody has this, you know, this is so important. The dam has broken. Nobody realizes it. And we're not going to realize it until we're literally trying to breathe water.
We're underwater.
Fight our way to the surface.
Right.
And that is a damn shame because everybody sees it. We just want to turn a cheek. Just want to look a different direction because it's not comfortable thinking about 300 million people out of jobs. It's not comfortable thinking about a society that doesn't have money. It goes against everything that we know. And so we're very resistant to it. It does not care. It does not sleep. It does not breathe. It does not have emotions. Mm-hmm. It does not care. It is just a thing. And at the point where that thing becomes an intelligence, it's not a scary, it's going to kill us all thing. So, you know, there's an opportunity for us to potentially learn more about ourselves than we have in the entire history of our species.
And that might scare you, perhaps. The inside, if you trace the inside of your soul and you say, what happens if I'm expanded exponentially outwards?
That's right.
Am I afraid of tech or am I afraid of my own self?
Or am I afraid of when I'm not special, I feel like I don't have self-worth. That sounds like you have a problem, not the technology. That sounds like you have a problem, not the society, right? It really comes down to people reflecting, you know, inwardly. And when they do, a lot of people don't like what they see. And so the system makes it very comfortable because I know I don't have to like what I see because I'm better than you because I have the watch, I have the car, I have the thing, all the stuff you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And so these status things, which drive me nuts, you know, I always get asked about watches. You know, everywhere I go, these.
I'm going to take mine off
just,
now, by the
no,
way.
No, just, so it's okay. Just like you. But my grandfather told me when I was young, the only people that wear a watch are people whose time belong to someone else.
God, come on, right? Dude, this is my show.
And,
what the
and
fuck?
So I was
this
like,
is my goddamn show.
I was like, and I was like,
you're fucking this up, man.
So I never owned a watch. My wife bought me a beautiful, super fancy Rolex. Uh-huh. She asked me the other day, where is the Rolex? Uh-huh. And I said, it's safe. And she goes, is it in the safe? I go, yeah,
sure.
I think so. I have an Apple Watch, the only watch I wear. And the reason I wear it, and they'll hate me for saying this because I want to say disclaimer, the Apple Watch does not warn you about a heart attack, but I'm under so much pressure all the time.
You're checking your blood
pressure.
I'm just
checking it. I'm just checking it, just making sure. I'm just like, it's like a comfort thing. It's like, oh, I feel better. There's nothing looks too crazy on there.
Okay. Let's, this conversation, it's funny how I could be talking about quantum and AI with you, but this dovetails with status and the way people find self-worth. These concepts are intertwined with one another.
Very much so.
Like on a molecular level.
Yeah.
Because even when we talk about the watch and these things, even when I even when I move in my own brain, of course, I'm both characters in my rich and really rich right. character, and I'm trying to move towards one ideal and away from another, right? And
which, by the way, fascinates me. Mm-hmm. It's why I watch your stuff.
It's a work in process. Awesome. When I look at these things, these material things, these symbols, the watch, the car, all this stuff, I've disconnected myself from it, and I say, this means this to everybody else. So I'm going to use this as a tool right. because everyone else probably thinks this means that. Right. And so therefore I am disconnected from it. You can take it all. Yep. It won't matter, but it might open the door in this particular room. And I'm usually right about that. So when it comes to these symbols and these objects and these cars and all this bullshit that we see on social media, like AI, it's just a tool.
That's right.
And it's just an inanimate object that you can either use to your advantage or not.
And, you know, in AI, you have the hallucination. You certainly have that in social media, too. I mean, come on, right? It's all the stuff you're talking about.
Yeah.
Like, everything you're doing is very important at this moment in time because we need more people thinking the way you're thinking because of where the technology is going to push society naturally. Because people aren't prepared for that change. People aren't prepared to not be important. And you know what? I'm waiting on it. I could not wait to be not important, not doing nothing. I would love to learn so many things that have nothing to do with anything other than that looks cool. I like to learn how to blow glass.
Sure.
You know, I'd like to, you know, get back to playing music. I don't have time for any of these things because, like we said earlier in that Warren Buffett example, I don't have the ability to make time.
Right.
And so on this mission, what it's done is it's eaten up all of my time. It's eaten into my family time. It's a real pain. But I feel like, you know, it's really important. In 1991, on Friday the 13th, I was pronounced dead twice. Okay. I was in a car accident, minor accident, but really bad. Fence post came through the window, ripped me apart. All right. But I was bleeding inside. And back then I had a big, you know, seatbelt mark, but I wasn't the driver. I was a passenger. Mm. And so they sent me home. So I'm bleeding death this whole time. And I've always thought about, why am I here? It completely changed my world, that experience, right? I thought, why am I here? And I've spent so much time. I've had times in my career where I've been depressed, almost to the point of suicidal. It's like, why am I, like, I should be doing something. Like, I should be dead. I'm alive. Mm-hmm. Why am I here? What is my purpose? And for the first time in my entire 52 years on this planet, I know I'm here to help bridge these gaps, to help try to make the world a better place, to try to demystify these technologies, to try to do this. I really feel like these two specific technologies, not technology in general, I'm not supposed to be, you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy, sure. Carl Sagan, these two things, they're going to change so fast our world and so such a dramatic change that I feel like that's what I'm here to do is to help with that democracy, to help with that. And I think that's what's giving me comfort during all of the I don't have time and everything is that this isn't about me.
Right.
This is about everybody listening. It's about all the people in the world who had that idea and couldn't build it and now have technology that could help them do that. This is about creating not thousands, hundreds of thousands or millions, but billions of entrepreneurs because now they have these capabilities that were walls around their goal that are now stair steps
right.
to elevating them both from a social status, from a mental health status, from everything and really getting them in this amazing creative spot that is the new economy. Just nobody sees it yet.
Yeah. I want to touch on one thing that you said that it's a coin with two sides. You say, I'm excited to not be important when this
yeah.
democratization moment happens. Now, I think on the other side, everyone becomes extremely important
that's
at the
right.
same time.
And that, so, that's exactly right. It's not a me coming down thing.
No, it's everyone coming up.
100%.
And what happens is I feel the most important. I've never felt more important. And I'm going to define importance. I feel confident that I'm doing something that is meaningful to me and is adding value. to society. So when I walk into a room now, I've never felt more confident in my entire life because finally, for the first fucking time, I'm doing something I love that other people love too.
This is exactly where I'm at in my career, right? For the first time, that's exactly where I'm at, which is it doesn't matter if it's those publishers in New York yesterday or the people in California last week or the people in California next week or the people in DC or whatever. I know I have a gift of knowledge and I'm giving it to as many people as I can in books, in the interviews, in the work we're doing, in the platform being free for everybody, whatever we can do to drive this is the most important thing. And by the way, I would love to see people, like somebody's more successful for, in the meantime, people still be in this system we're in today. So let's say that we do something, somebody uses something I made and they're infinitely successful and they make $100 million for themselves. Go you.
Right.
I don't give a shit. Money's right. not what's driving me. Money's never driven me. I grew up without it. It doesn't have any hold over me. It doesn't have any value. You know, I mean, I've done all the crazy things with my success. You know, I bought a McLaren. I traded it for a Tesla. I sold the Tesla. I don't have a car. Like they just, these things don't matter. What matters to me is that look on a child's face when they're like, oh, the aha moment and they can do something and they get excited. What matters to me is going to these high schools and universities and helping hopefully inspire these kids that you don't have to live in the world that was created for you. You can create your entire new world and you're the first generation that's going to have ability to create that in ways it could never before be done. That like the bridle is out of their mouths, the leash is off, whatever you want to do, they are free to do so many things. To go to board members and say, the world is changing and you know what? You're still going to be okay.
Right.
But guess what? It's not going to be the way that it was. Having these conversations fascinates me. It drives me and it makes me feel like this is great because I'm not out to make $1 billion. I don't have any, you know, look, I'm going to return money to my investors. It's great. We can do that and be an amazing group of people that does really great things. There's nothing wrong with those. Those aren't mutually exclusive. And I feel like, again, I have this gift and I want to give it to as many people as possible. And I have never felt so fulfilled as when you open somebody's eyes to something that they thought they couldn't understand and you leave the room and they've already signed up for an account here doing that and they're playing what they're doing. That's the goal. That's what is good. I go, that was successful.
Yeah.
Right? That's what success looks like to me is not my success, but everybody else's. You know, we built the company kind of as the Switzerland of quantum and AI, right? We have tons of partners, dozens and dozens of partners. And we don't judge, you know, that we know their secrets, we don't share them. We don't say this machine's better than that or this AI is better. You know, we just use it all. And that has really bled through every part of my life over the last, you know, 5-6 years. As we've really started this adventure with the company about 7 years since I was like, I'm definitely doing quantum, but it's so wonderful. It's so empowering to be like, I don't care. You know what? I'm less straight. You know what my wife told me the other night? She's a professional organizer. She's the savior of my life. She's an amazing woman, but she reads and listens to books more than anybody, you know? I mean, 20, 30, 40 books. Like she's just going through stuff and she always pulls out stuff and she'll text me or she'll send me stuff. And she told me the other night, she goes, you should tell yourself, I don't allow myself to be overwhelmed. Because for the first time in my career, since like when I went to work answering phones at Apple in 1993, I have found myself being like this is overwhelming. Like this technology, like I'm talking to all these people and I'm going from a elementary school to a Senate meeting to a this, to a that. And I'm just like, God. And she's like, you should just tell yourself, don't be overwhelmed. And I thought, wait, isn't that kind of what I'm trying to tell people? Don't be overwhelmed by this technology. Let me show you how easy it is for you to have as much of this knowledge as anybody else, for you to be put on an equal footing.
Right.
And it literally, this happened like, I think a week and a half ago, and I was going into this crazy killer week, and all week I've never been so relaxed coming to see you, doing other stuff, other interviews, speeches, because I'm like, that's right. I'm just not gonna allow myself to be overwhelmed. I was like, that's what I'm teaching people. Why am I then doing that behavior myself?
Right.
Right. That doesn't make me very good at showing, leading by example. It was such a wonderful moment.
This is equally, I'm not even sure if this is a conversation about technology anymore. It's a conversation of the human spirit.
That's right.
It's a combination of meeting the oracle, perhaps out in the wild, meeting the phenomenon of infinite information and possibility. And,
you know, we have a trademark on that, that we stole, from Dr. Strange. I love Dr. Strange. And my wife took me to see the first Dr. Strange movie. And as we walked in the theater, the poster said, "The impossibilities are endless." And I thought, that's the company we're building. And I went and I filed the trademark and software on "The impossibilities are endless." And that was that and herding Schrodinger's cats were our two things when we started. But you know, so you say that, I say, think of it not as the possibilities, think of it as the impossibilities. And the reason I was drawn to that so fast, and the reason that I use that is, this isn't about, just like it's not about the problems of the past, it's about the opportunities of the future. It's not about what we think is possible. It's actually about all the things we think that are impossible, that we haven't taken the step on those journeys,
right?
Because we've just made that assumption. All of those things, that's where the magic is. That's where space travel and interplanetary and curing diseases and eliminating them.
And personal achievement.
And personal achievement, all existing. That's right. Because the people we're talking about, they don't think it's possible for them to be doing what you're doing or doing what I'm doing or doing. That's exactly right. That's an impossibility to them. So I would say the impossibilities are endless. And these machines, these technologies, they make the impossible possible.
Whirly, you blew my fucking mind today, man.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming out to Chicago. This was awesome. So many similar wavelengths here.
I love it. This is a true
pleasure.
Well, we'll stay in touch and hopefully we'll do something again in the future.
Absolutely, man.
All right.
See you soon.
Thanks for having me.